We're going to start today in Matthew chapter 5, but while you're turning there, I'll give you a little bit of a background, so to speak, on what we're going to talk about. In Galatians 5, 22 and 23, which we'll get to a little bit later, you don't have to turn there right now, we're going to get there a little bit later, there's a list of things that the Bible refers to as the fruit of the Spirit. It says the fruit of the Spirit is, and it lists some things out there. So in Matthew chapter 5, verse 5, we're gonna spend our time this morning talking about one particular verse. We're going to spend our time talking about verse 5. It's part of the Sermon on the Mount, one of the so-called Beatitudes, as it's referred to in, oftentimes by people. Matthew 5, 5 says, "Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth." So we're going to talk about that verse in three different aspects this morning. We're going to talk about the word blessed. What does that mean? We're going to talk about the word meek. What does that mean? We're going to talk about that last phrase at the end, inherit the earth. And I think if you can define those three things, you can kind of put them together, you have a pretty good understanding of what this verse is trying to drive at. But we'll probably spend most of our time around the concept of meek. Matter of fact, I kind of titled this in my own head as I was going through this and studying for it. I titled it Meekness, a Quiet Strength. Right? Because that's really what it is. We'll get into more depth into that definition in a little bit. But in Galatians 5 and 22, in that list that lists things like love and faith and all those other things, meekness is on that list. So that tells us something about the concept of meekness. Even if we might not know what it is right now, even though we haven't defined it yet, we can start to learn a little bit about it based on the fact that it's on that list. It's on that list with faith and love and other things. In other words, like faith, like love, in similar fashion to them, meekness is something that we can both possess and express. We call those Christian graces. You've heard me use the phrase the grace of faith. Faith is a grace that's given to us. It's something we possess in regeneration. We're given it. But then we can express it by how we live, how we walk. We're instructed to walk by faith, to express that faith. Meekness is similar to that in the sense that it's something we're given because the Spirit takes up residence in our heart. And if meekness is a fruit of the Spirit, then meekness is there. But then we have to express it, right? Now, I don't want to try to dumb this down too much. I know it may seem a little overly simplistic, but here's kind of how I think about it. And I know this analogy isn't perfect, so please don't carry it farther than I intended. I think of those things in Galatians 5, 22 as a set of tools, right? So I've got a tool bag out here in the back that I packed up specifically for this time period within which we're having to live temporarily, just in case we needed them. And I'm glad I did, because we've had a few things we've had to fix here and there from the camper standpoint. We've had a few water leaks, a couple of things like that that we've had to repair. And I've been thankful to have those tools with me. And that tool bag, in that tool bag are a variety of tools. I made sure I had a pair of channel locks, a good pair of pliers, something I could turn something with. I've got a little socket set just in case I needed to tighten a nut or a bolt or something like that. I've got a couple of good multi-screwdrivers, 11-in-1 style screwdrivers that can do anything from Phillips head to flatheads to square drives to star drives, you know, just so I'd have something that I could use on almost anything I needed. I had a whole set of different things that I thought of. Now, there's probably some things I forgot about so far. I haven't run into that yet, thank goodness. But it was, you know, I put together this toolbox, and I had this little bag, and I put together these tools in it, and inside that bag was a variety of tools. Now, I've got them. They're out there, and I can either choose to use them or not. And that's kind of the way tools are. You know, there's an old adage about a man who only has a hammer. If he only has a hammer, everything looks like a nail, right? If he only has a hammer, all he can do is hit it. It's good to have different tools that are specific to the task, right? Sometimes it's good to have a screwdriver. Sometimes a screwdriver does you no good at all, right? Sometimes it's good to have a set of sockets, but sometimes it's not useful. And it doesn't really matter how many tools you have. If you don't use them, they're not of much value. Not at least in a in an expression sort of way. So I think of Galatians 5:22 kind of like that. The Spirit of God takes up residence in our heart. He's kind of the tool bag. He's coming along. He's there, and within Him is the fruit of the Spirit, and all these tools that we can use come along with Him, right? And we have them. Now the question is, do we express them very often? And sometimes the answer is no. Sometimes the answer is yes. We ebb and flow in our service and in our life. And our objective is to try to ebb up instead of down. And yes, it's a challenge, but that's kind of the way it is. And meekness is one of those things, right? It's one of those tools that's in that tool bag. We possess it, but do we often use it? And I think it's important to see it that way, to understand that it's a Christian grace. We'll talk more about that later. It's a Christian grace. It's a gift that's given to us by grace. That's what we mean by a Christian grace. It's a gift that's given us by grace. It's not something that we generate or work up, right? It's something that we're given and then we're called upon to express. And we'll talk about that more a little bit later. But let's talk about this particular verse, Matthew 5:5. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. So I've got three questions I want to answer. You may have other questions. I may or may not answer them. And if I don't answer them, you can ask me afterward. And I'll tell you right now, if you ask me afterward, I may or may not answer it then, because I may not know. I don't know everything, that's for sure. So my three questions are this. What does it mean to be blessed? What does that mean? So we need to talk about that a little bit. Second, what does it mean to be meek? I think that's a terribly misunderstood term. In a modern culture situation, in a modern society, I don't think people understand what the Bible means when it says, blessed are the meek. What does that mean? What does it mean when somebody is meek? And lastly, what does it mean to inherit the earth? Now, if there's any one of these three that I think is the least understood, it's probably that one. And I'm going to prove it when I show you that I don't really know 100% either, and I have a couple of options I'm going to present to you, and then I'm going to tell you the one I lean to in the end, okay? So let's talk about the word blessed. I've heard my entire life and most of my ministry that when the Bible uses the term blessed, that what it means is happy. Blessed is the man. Happy is the man. Now, let me start here by saying that I'm not here to completely contradict that thought. I do think there's an element of truth to that. I just think that's a pretty small, narrow view of what that term really means. I think there's more to it than that. I think it's deeper than that. And I think there's something far bigger at stake when we talk about the word blessed. I think that's selling it short, so to speak. It means a lot more than just happy. Happy is circumstantial. Right? I'm happy when I sit down at a table and I'm served a really, really good meal. Our family vacations, we're foodies. A lot of what we do revolves around food. You know, Bill's been trying to learn that about our family as we go on. He'll ask me questions from time to time. What did your family do specifically around Christmas? What did your family do different around? And I'm like, you know what, Bill? Mostly food. Yeah. Do y'all have any special things you do when you're going back? Yeah, we go out to eat. It revolves around food. We like good food. And we do things like that every year. We get together as a family at Christmas time, either before or after somewhere, and we take all the kids and we try to go to a really nice restaurant and we have a really good meal. And lately we've gotten kind of hooked on the Cherokee Chop House over in on the other side, over in Marietta, on the other side of Barrett Parkway, other end of Barrett Parkway, off of Highway 5. Really enjoy a good steak, and that makes me happy. Right? I like good food. I'm happy when I can curl up on a cold day like this in a warm spot and do nothing. Makes me happy. My happiness is largely circumstantial. It depends on the circumstances under which I'm operating at that time. Okay? You want to see me get unhappy? When I was a young kid growing up, we lived in, obviously, in eastern Kentucky. Most of you know that. It'd get pretty cold up there in the wintertime. We had a lot more snow there than we have here. Not a lot as the people up north did. They would laugh at the snow we had in Kentucky. But, you know, from time to time, we'd have those 6, 7, 8-inch snows. We'd have maybe 3 of those a year for several 1 to 2-inch snows a year. And we had well water. We didn't have city water, so we had a well out back, and there was a building around it. And you'd have to go out there and put a light bulb in the building in the wintertime when it got cold. Make sure your pipes didn't freeze. You want to see me unhappy? Let it get below 0 and the pipes freeze. And they burst. And I have to go fix it in the middle of that kind of temperature and weather. That's not a happy day. Having to get out there and work with wet, soggy stuff in really cold temperatures. Not happy about it. Just recently, I had to make a trip to Plymouth, North Carolina, to visit a pulp mill, and we went up there, and it was in the teens. We got up that morning, walked into that mill, and you know, most southern industrial complexes, not much is indoors because we don't freeze that often. Most of us build outside. I would rather be at the pulp mill in International Falls, Wisconsin, in the wintertime than one in the south when it's that cold. Because up there, everything's inside. You know, as long as you don't open a door, it can be 40 below outside and nobody cares. Right? But you come down here and it's like 13 and 80% humidity and you're walking around outside and this stuff's just eating through your clothes. I wasn't happy about walking around that pulp mill at all. It just wasn't my happy place. Happiness is circumstantial. It is driven by the external. What's going on around us largely determines whether we're happy or not. Have we had enough to eat? Have we had enough sleep? We can get grumpy if we don't sleep enough, right? Everybody here knows that. Everybody's met somebody or is looking at their spouse right now going, yeah, I've seen that happen. And when they don't get enough sleep, they can get a little grumpy, right? Happiness is dependent upon our circumstances. If the car breaks down and appliance is broke, we're shelling out money for this and that, and it seems like those things always come in waves, we get unhappy in a hurry. Right? Now, blessedness and happiness can overlap because blessedness can create happiness, but they're not the same thing. So in order to understand that, let's look at the rest of the Beatitudes a little bit. I'm not going to go through and read them, but I want you to think about it a little bit. They describe a blessed condition that is often contrary to our emotional state. Happiness is an emotional state. But blessedness often occurs even when our emotional state is a mess. Blessed are the poor in spirit. Blessed are they that mourn. Do you know many happy mourners? I don't. Blessed are they that hunger and thirst. Right? So I want you to see that blessedness isn't necessarily a reaction to external circumstances the way happiness is. Blessedness is more of a disposition than it is an emotional response. It's a state of being. It's a position. And matter of fact, I would argue that blessedness is something that God declares over someone. God is saying, if you're a mourning spirit, you are blessed. If you hunger and thirst after righteousness, then God is saying over you, you're a blessed soul. That's what's going on here. He's saying if you're meek, if you have meekness in your heart and you have the ability to express it, then blessed are you. See, blessedness is not simply an emotional response. It's not just saying, happy is the man that does this or happy is the man that has this. It's saying that God is saying that for the person that experiences meekness and expresses it, that they have, that God is declaring that that person is a blessed individual. It describes a state of divine approval. It's a position. We talk about things that are positional versus things that we labor for. We say that we are sons of God by position. He makes us a son. We didn't make ourselves a son. I didn't make myself the child of Philip and Dola Hoskins by my own labor. That happened to me. I don't make myself a child of God any more than I made myself a child of my parents. I have no control over my natural birth. Likewise, I have no control over my spiritual birth, which is exactly the lesson that Jesus was trying to get across to Nicodemus when he talked to him and said, you must be born again. And when Nicodemus didn't understand that, he said, listen, the wind bloweth where it listeth. You can hear the sound thereof. You can see the effects of it in the world. But you can't tell where it comes from, and you can't tell where it's going next. And he says, so is everyone that is born of the Spirit of God. In other words, we have no control over the Spirit of God with respect to regeneration and bringing people into the family of God. That is solely in the hands of a sovereign God who speaks to the heart of his children at his appointed time, when he pleases, where he pleases, and how he pleases. God is in control of that. That's positional. Sonship is positional. Discipleship is conditional. How you live determines whether or not you are a disciple of Christ. How you live has no effect on whether you're his son. He makes you his son. Even when the prodigal son had taken his inheritance from his fathers and had carried it off into a foreign land and was spending it on riotous living, he was still his father's son. That had not changed. But he wasn't a follower of his father at all. Right? He had lost fellowship with him. Blessedness is a state of divine approval. It's granted by God, and it's often completely independent of circumstance. Often, folks who are in the worst of circumstances are described as blessed. Blessed are they that mourn. Blessed are the poor in spirit. And yes, blessed are the meek. So don't think of blessed as just being happy. Think of it as the fact that God has divinely declared you to be a blessed individual. So now let's talk about what it means to be meek. What does it mean to be meek? Common misconception is that meekness means to be weak. We live in a world today where often meekness is portrayed as a weakness. That if you want something, you need to be bold enough to stand up, go grab it, be loud, be proud. Make a lot of noise, the squeaky wheel gets the grease kind of mentality. Draw attention to yourself, stand up. The Bible says that we're to be meek. So let's talk a little bit about what that means. Matter of fact, meekness is quite the opposite of weakness. It actually implies a great deal of strength, but it describes a strength that is quiet. A quiet strength. You understand what I'm saying? Historically, the word meek, I found this interesting as I studied on that word a little bit. Historically, in the English language, the word meek was often used to describe a horse that had been broken to be ridden. Saddle broke. Now, I don't know if any of you all have ever been involved in breaking horses, you know, as they come up. I had a cousin that lived down the road from me that raised horses, and we used to go help a little bit. I've helped bridle break. I've helped saddle break horses. There's nothing like climbing on top of an animal that outweighs you by 10 times, knowing that it doesn't want you to be there. I mean, it's got control at that point. I remember one time, I know I've told this story, but I remember one time when we bridle broke a colt long after we should have. My cousin had gotten sick. He'd had the flu or something. I forget what it was. He had bought this small colt with the intent of bridle breaking it right away. Unfortunately, he got the flu several weeks in. It's amazing how much bigger and stronger a young horse can get in a few weeks. There's a particular time when you should do this, when you can control that animal and you can get a bridle in its mouth and hang on to it. So we decided we were going to confine it a little bit because it was a little bit stronger than most of the colts we'd ever bridle broke. We took it to a little pole barn he had that had boards nailed to the outside. It was open on each end. And his son got it around the neck, and I had it around the rear haunch. And as soon as we got a hold of it, he says, "If y'all got it," we're like, "Get that bridle on that horse, you know, because we're about to lose it here." And he goes to shove that bridle in that colt's mouth, and when he did, that colt lunged, and we went toward the wall. Fortunately, we were on that side of the horse, not on that side. The horse went through the wall. We went with it. And we're laying on the outside with all those boards pushed off because they were nailed from the outside. We're now laying on top of them. I'm worried about rolling over on a nail. I mean, it's like, okay, get the bridle in that horse while he got it on the ground. And he did. You know, we get done, and his son's got blood coming out of one of his shoes where that horse is, you know, hooved on top of his shoe on the way down. I mean, it's just really tough. These are strong animals, right? I mean, when you think about it, these animals are really powerful. And, you know, once you bridle break and saddle break that horse, he didn't get weak. He's still as strong as he ever was. And if you don't believe that, get on one, ride it for a while, and then let it get startled to where you lose control, and you'll find out just how strong that horse is. Because you can't control it if it doesn't want to be controlled. The reason the word meekness was used to describe a broken horse was because it was still strong, but its strength was restrained by its training and by discipline. That strength had been harnessed in a way that made it useful to the owner, to the rider, to the one who wanted to plow a field. Same could be said about other animals that were broken to pull plows and different things. It was still a strong animal. But that strength had become very, very quiet. And this is kind of the aspect that God is pointing us to when he says, "Blessed are the meek." Meekness is more of a disposition than anything else. It's not like happy. Happy is an external emotional reaction. Meekness is a continuing disposition. So let's try to see if we can define what meekness looks like, because it's easier to talk about in terms of what it looks like than it is to try to give a detailed definition. And I'm going to give you somebody else's definition. Like I said, I don't often read directly from things that I found, but I thought this was good, and I couldn't say it any better. So this comes right out of John Gill's commentary, where he talks about this particular verse. And he describes what meekness is. And he says, "The meek are they," and then here's his quote, "who are not easily provoked to anger, who patiently bear and put up with injuries and affronts. The meek are they who carry themselves courteously and affably toward others. Meek are they who have the meanest," or the lowest, that's what the word meanest means here, "the lowest of thoughts of themselves and the best of others. A meek spirit is someone who does not envy the gifts and graces of other men, are willing to be instructed and admonished by the meanest or the lowest of saints. They quietly submit to the will of God, even in adverse dispensations of providence. In other words, when God has providentially brought difficulty in their life, they still quietly submit to God. And they ascribe all they have and all that they are to the grace of God. That's what meekness looks like. Meekness in particular is those people who think less of themselves and more of others. Every positive that they have, they ascribe that to God. Don't look at me. It's God that did this in me. God worketh in me both to will and to do of his good pleasure. So a truly meek person is one who is in control. He's not quick to anger. He doesn't fly off the handle with the temper. People say, well, I've got a quick temper. It's just the way God made me. No, it's not. That's the way you made yourself. God gave you his spirit, and his spirit has as its fruit a spirit of meekness, which is a spirit of self-control, slow to anger, patience with others, patience with circumstance, who thinks more highly of others than they do themselves, who speaks lowly of themselves but glowingly of those around them, and attributes every positive in their life to the grace of God. That's a meek and lowly spirit. So you see, meekness isn't weakness at all. It's the ability to stand in strength in the face of adversity and continue to follow the Lord. Now, when I say it's not weakness, that's easy enough to say. I can just say that and y'all can go, well, I agree with the preacher. Or you can go, well, prove it. Okay, let's prove it. How about that? Let me give you two examples where the scripture describes someone as meek, and I think you'll see that these are not weak people. Number one, this is in Numbers chapter 12. It's in parentheses, so it's the description of an individual in the midst of a story, and all of a sudden the writer puts in parentheses this description. It says, now the man Moses, this is Numbers chapter 12, verse 3. Now the man Moses was very meek. Not only was he very meek, listen to what he says. Above all men which were upon the face of the earth. Now, I know sometimes we speak in hyperbole. We see somebody that we know, we love, especially at the passing of an individual, and we'll be talking about them, and we'll say to somebody else, you know, there's not a better man that I've ever met. And we mean that somewhat hyperbolically. We might say, well, he was the kindest person I've ever been around. I was the kindest person in the world. Well, I've not met every person in the world, so how do I know whether that's the kindest person in the world or not? There's a couple of preachers I know in particular that I've described on many occasions as the kindest people I've ever met. And they are extremely kind men. And I might even express them as the kindest men in the world. But I don't know that for sure, because I've never met every person in the world. But listen, God described Moses as the meekest man upon the face of the earth at that time. And may I tell you, that was not hyperbole. Why? Because God actually knew every man on the earth. He could say that without stretching the truth. He could say that without doubt or concern. He was saying to us that at the time that this was written, there was not a man on the earth that was more meek than Moses. But let me tell you something about Moses. Moses was an extremely strong leader. He was. He was a strong individual. He led a mighty nation out of captivity, out of slavery, across the Red Sea, through the wilderness, all the way to the banks of the Jordan. 40 years in the wilderness, he led those people. Yes, there were challenges at times. There were difficulties. There were mild rebellions from time to time, complaints and murmuring. But in the end, Moses kept them together until God finally brought them to the place that they were finally prepared to enter the promised land. Moses was by no means a weak man. He stood face to face with Pharaoh and demanded that Pharaoh let God's people go. He stood face to face with Pharaoh at one time, threw his staff on the ground, and it became a serpent. You remember that? I find that fascinating. You know what I find most fascinating about it? Is all the wise men, sorcerers, and stuff of Pharaoh's, they threw their staffs on the ground too. Now, I don't know what happened. Because when they threw their staffs on the ground, they became serpents as well. But I'm going to tell you something I think. Trust me, this is just me thinking. This isn't scripture, so please don't. I think they were just as surprised as anybody when those staffs turned to serpents. I don't think they had any clue that was going to work. They just knew they had to do something, because if they didn't counter Moses' arguments, Pharaoh would have them killed. So you might as well throw your staff down like he did. And I have a feeling that when their staffs turned to serpents, they went, I don't know if that's true or not, but I think it is. One of the reasons I think it's true is because the Bible tells me that God has control of life and death. That the evil one of this world does not have the power of creation and certainly cannot create life. Now, it's possible that those staffs were serpents to start with, and that there was some sort of trick they were using to make them appear as staffs, and that when they let go of them, they began to act like the serpents they were. That's possible. I've heard that argument. But I wonder at times if they weren't just as shocked, and that God providentially transformed their staffs into serpents for the sole purpose of what was about to happen next. Because everybody remember what happened next? Moses' staff that became a serpent crawled over and ate all the other serpents that were on the ground. I wonder sometimes if the thought process of those sorcerers when they threw them down went, "Ooh, thank you. That was amazing. Uh-oh. That's not good." You know? Can you imagine being there? Moses is described as meek, and he's described as the meekest man on the planet. And yet he was one of the strongest leaders of that day. Second man that I want to talk about. Matthew chapter 11. Matthew chapter 11, starting in verse 28, it says, this is nothing you haven't heard before. It says, "Come unto me, all ye that labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest." Now, that's often quoted as an invitation to the lost to come to Jesus. That's not an invitation at all. That's a commandment to the living. It's a commandment to those that have a burden, that are heavy laden, that God has already touched in their heart so that they see themselves as sinners and unrighteous. They see themselves as broken and undone. Come unto me, all ye that labor and are heavy laden. And he says, I will give you rest. But listen to what he says next. Take my yoke upon you and learn of me. This is Jesus speaking. For I am meek and lowly in heart, and ye shall find rest unto your souls. Now, I know the world doesn't understand Jesus the way we understand Jesus, so I'm not expecting the world out there to understand what I'm about to say. Jesus was not weak. Matter of fact, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. And we know that, speaking of Jesus, because a little bit later in that same chapter it says, and the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. Jesus did not lay aside his deity and come into this world to become a weak and lowly man. No. He was still God when he was here. He was God manifest in the flesh. Fully God, fully man. He laid aside his glory for a season, but he did not lay aside his deity. Jesus was as strong as any man had ever been, and stronger, because he had the power of God inside of him. Because he was God, is God, ever has been God, the second person of the Trinity, the Son of God, equal with God. And the Jews understood that. At least they understood that's what he was claiming. Because he said, listen, my sheep hear my voice. I know them, and they follow me. And he said, they'll never perish. He says, no man can pluck them out of my hand. He says, I and the Father are one, and no man can pluck them out of my Father's hand. Now, what happened after Jesus made that startling claim? Now, it doesn't sound that startling to us. We're accustomed to it. But when he made that claim on that day to that audience, there was an open and honest gasp in the crowd. The Bible didn't say that. I believe there was. They were shocked. That was a radical, revolutionary claim. What claim was it? I and the Father are one. What happened? They took up stones. The Jews took up stones to stone him. They were going to take his life right there. And he said to them, for what good work that I have done, what good work do you intend to stone me over? And they said, none of your works. That's not the issue. They said, it's because it's blasphemy that's the issue, and blasphemy that you have made yourself equal with God. They considered that blasphemous. It's one of the few times that they leveled an accusation against Christ that wasn't a false accusation, because he was exactly doing that. He had definitely declared himself to be equal with God because he is God. Right? So we have two particular people in Scripture that the Bible refers to as meek. God calls Moses the meekest man on the planet at the time, and Jesus refers to himself as one who is meek and lowly of heart. Meekness is not just a virtue, by the way. This is what we were talking about earlier. This is what a lot of people think. Meekness is a virtue. We look at Jesus and we see that he had this quiet strength about him, right? It's pretty obvious. He just went about his business. in spite of what people said, in spite of what people did, even when his own family turned against him, even when his own brothers and sisters wouldn't come in the house where he was preaching and ask for him to come outside, he said, if they want to talk to me, tell them to come in. He didn't stop doing what he was doing. He didn't back off. He didn't create a big stir. He didn't generate a protest or a riot. He simply went about his business, preaching the gospel message, healing the sick, making the lame to walk, causing the blind to see, doing what the Father had sent him to do. Quietly demonstrating what it meant and what it should look like to be a disciple of Christ. He accepted any attack upon himself without defense. When they came to take him, to carry him to the courts, he didn't fight. When they took him out there to place him on that cross, there was no wrestling match. When his disciples drew a sword and lashed out, he said, put that back. Would you not? Would you not that I be about my Father's business? Do you not understand that there's a cup that I must drink? He went about his way with quiet resolve. But when they attacked the Lord's house, when he showed up and there was money changers and they had turned the Lord's house into a house of merchandise, a place to make a profit rather than a place to worship, he sat down in a corner, collected the materials necessary, and he made himself a whip. And then he rose up and he drove every person there out of the temple at the end of a whip. And when they were all gone and the hall was empty and the only sound there was the echo of his own sandals as they scrubbed across the floor, he went around the room and he tossed every table on its side. Why? Because this is the Lord's house. This was not an attack upon his person, but an attack upon his Father. And that he would not stand for. And quietly, he made a difference in the world. Now, a lot of people think meekness is simply a virtue, right? This is something that you acquire of your own effort. You learn and you execute. You see it in somebody else, you emulate it. It's a virtue like being honest. Or like being sincere, being trustworthy. Those are virtues, right? We talk about virtues. Being a hard worker, that's a virtue. Everybody here should aspire toward being a hard worker. When you do something, do it as though you're doing it for the Lord. Do it to His glory. Do it to the best of your ability. I don't care if it's the next spelling test when you're in the third grade or whether it's the job you do for your employer today, or whether it's something you're doing at home. Do it to the best of your ability. Do it to the glory of the Lord. That's a virtue, isn't it? Meekness isn't simply a virtue. It's more than that. A virtue is something that one is called to add to their faith. Add to your faith virtue, right? It's something you're called to add on to what God has already given you. Meekness is not something we add on to what God has given us. Meekness is something that we're given. Galatians 5:22, that's what we're talking about. 5:22, but the fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, long-suffering, gentleness, goodness, faith. Verse 23, meekness, temperance. Against such there is no law. It's a fruit of the Spirit. It comes with the Spirit in regeneration. We're given meekness. Every person in this room that's been born of the Spirit of Almighty God has the spirit of meekness within them. It's a gift. So meekness is not a virtue, something that we're called to add to our faith. But like faith, it's a Christian grace. It's a gift that God gives us that we don't deserve. Therefore, we call it a grace. That which we don't deserve is grace. Like faith, it's a possession first. We come out of that regenerative experience not knowing what's happened to us, sensible of our sin for the first time in our existence, understanding that we've fallen so far short and will continue to, and there's no hope for us. We come out of that experience with that crushing feeling of the weight of our sin. And what are we waiting for? We're waiting for the sound of the gospel to tell us what Jesus did to remedy that situation. But in that regenerative experience, there are things that we come out of it possessing. One is faith, love, temperance, joy, but one of them is meekness. We come out of the regenerative experience with a quiet strength that we now have access to that can carry us through the darkest and deepest hours of our life. And because you have it, because you have meekness, God has declared you blessed. Blessed are the meek. The meek are not loud and boisterous. They're not attention seekers. Rather, they're those that stand for what is right quietly while preferring the welfare of others above themselves. These are not people that go fight for their own rights. These are people that fight for the rights of others. But do it in a quiet strength. Psalm 147, verses 5 and 6 says this. It says, great is our Lord, and of great power his understanding is infinite. Listen, the Lord lifteth up the meek. He casteth the wicked down to the ground. The Lord lifteth up the meek. See, meekness is a position of grace. God places us there. God places us there. We've got a little bit of time left. Let's talk about this last phrase. What does it mean to inherit the earth? Well, we understand what it means to be blessed. That's a declaration of God upon his children as he chooses to give it. We understand what it means to be, what meekness is. Meekness is a gift that we're given in regeneration, and it's essentially a quiet strength. It is closely related to humility, by the way. There's a lot of similarities between meekness and humility. Meekness are those that are obediently following the Lord, quietly living in the strength that God has given them. What we're talking about. We know what those two are. So blessed are the meek. For, why are they blessed? Because, I want you to notice that in the Beatitudes, by the way, every one of them has the same format. Blessed are something. Because. And every one of those becauses is a promise. Is a declaration that these people are going to receive a promise of God. This isn't the promise itself. He's not giving the promise. This promise comes from somewhere else. But he's saying these things, these promises belong to these people. It's a declaration, not a set of conditions. So a lot of people think the Beatitudes is a recipe. If you can learn to be mourn, if you can learn to be poor in spirit, if you can learn to be meek, then you can get these blessings. That's not what it's about. It's a declaration that those who are these things will have these promises. And one of those promises is right here. Blessed are the meek. because they shall inherit the earth. Now, you might look around today and go, no, thank you. I watched the news last night. I was on Facebook this morning. I've seen what's going on in this earth, and quite frankly, I don't want it. And you know what? I don't blame you. I wouldn't want it either. So let me give you some good news. That's not what it's talking about. You're not winning Venezuela or Colombia or the United States of America either. None of these nations that we look at in this world is the object of our faith, of our future. None of them bring us the joy and blessedness that the Scripture's talking about. I love the country we live in. Trust me, I love the freedoms we experience. I don't want them to go away. I'll stand and fight for them. I believe in the Bible first. Trust me, Bible first. But I am a constitutionalist. I think that document was really well done. And I think the first 10 amendments, the Bill of Rights, which were largely written by a Baptist preacher, they're not sacred, but boy, they're up there. I think they're powerful. The right of free speech, the right to privacy, which is implied within them, you know, protections against unreasonable search and seizure, all that kind of stuff. You know, the things that allow us to walk down the street without being harassed. I think they're important. I think they're what makes our nation different than anything we've ever experienced in this world ever. So don't get me wrong, I love the country we live in. But there's a country far more important to me than the one that's codified in the Constitution of the United States of America. Far bigger to me. A kingdom that Jesus talked about. So I'm going to give you two potential definitions of inherit the earth. I'm not sure which one's right. I'm going to tell you which one I think's right. I'm going to give you the one that I don't lean to first. I always start with the negative. I'm going to give you the one that I've heard, but I'm not sure I believe first. And that is that it refers to the providential experience, or it refers to the experience, if you will, of the child of grace here in this life, as they are providentially exalted by God. In other words, some believe that what it's saying is, blessed are the meek, because from time to time, God will providentially exalt them, letting them know He's near, letting them know He's there. We might call that a kingdom experience. That the blessing of living in the kingdom comes. And we might look at examples of that in the Old Testament and see people like Joseph, who was exalted to practically leader of all of Egypt. Or we might think of Daniel, who was exalted to a prince position within the nation of Babylon. How God providentially exalted those men in due time because they belonged to Him. And because He loved them. Some would argue that that's what this is talking about. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. In other words, blessed are those God hath declared, those whom He hath given meekness, to be blessed because He will exalt them in due time in this life from time to time that they might know Him. That's one way to look at it. Not my interpretation. I tend to lean toward this next one. I think it refers to the coming of the new earth. You know, over there in Peter where it says there's coming a new heavens and a new earth. And I know a lot of people think that new heavens and new earth is the kingdom we're living in now. And I do think there's probably a dual fulfillment of that particular prophecy. I think you can refer to the kingdom that's coming, New Jerusalem, this kingdom now. But I also think it somewhat refers to what's coming, truly coming. right? Heaven. Well, why would God call it a new heaven and new earth? Because that is something we can comprehend. We see our life around a globe and a world and an earth. And he wanted to put it in terms that we can understand the earth we're on is a mess. We all know it. We've looked out there. We read the papers. Well, there's no papers anymore. We read stuff on the internet. We see the news. We hear it every single day. 24-hour coverage of the carnage that's going on in our world. And our world, this earth, is falling apart. And he's telling us that there's something new coming. This earth is going to be destroyed, and we're going to have something new. So I do think there's a sense in which what he's talking about here is the eternal. Let me see if I can help you a little bit with that. This Matthew 5:5 is actually a quote from Psalm 37. I don't know how many people knew that. Some of you probably knew that and been wondering if I would ever get to that. Psalm 37, verse 11 says, "But the meek shall inherit the earth and shall delight themselves in the abundance of peace." And then it says in verse 12, I wanted to pick this up just so we could get this. It says, "The wicked plotteth against the just and gnasheth upon him with his teeth." Now, the reason I wanted to grab those two verses together is because they are together in context. And they show us that in this particular case, when the original scripture was written that talks about the meek inheriting the earth, that the meek was being contrasted with the wicked. And that gives me a sense that there is an eternal flavor to what we're talking about. There's an eternal truth to what we're describing here. I think that it probably refers to the coming new earth that's spoken of when Scripture speaks of the fact that this earth in which we live will be dissolved with a fervent heat and the melting fire of God. It'll be consumed, and that we wait for a new heaven and a new earth that's not like this one, that's not falling apart, that's not loaded with sin, that's not loaded with despair, that doesn't have loss, that doesn't have sickness, that doesn't have trials, that doesn't have tears. We're waiting on something that's far better than what we have today. And he said, "Blessed are they that have been given the gift and grace of meekness, because they shall inherit the earth." This thing that he's talking about is an inheritance, child of grace, that's been reserved for every child of God without exception. We will not be left behind. There is no such thing as the left behind. You understand? Jesus is coming back. He's coming back for his people. And the meek is a way here of describing who those people are. I think it's more than just an experience of providential grace here in this life. I think what we're seeing is a declaration from the mouth of Jesus himself of the promise of God to not leave us here. I think Jesus was saying to his disciples, "You're a blessed people because there's something better coming for you that the wicked will never experience." You know, the wicked, they live here in this earth and they experience a lot of the good things that we experience. The rain falls on the just and the unjust. The wicked experience career success from time to time. We see people that get to the top of corporate ladders by climbing on other people and stabbing others in the back. We see people that succeed through dishonesty and deception. We see politicians that lie constantly and they become millionaires on the backs of constituents and people that are simply trying to scratch out a living here in this world. And we wonder, why does this happen? Well, let me tell you something, child of God. There's an experience coming for you that the wicked will never know. And I think that's incredible. I don't take pride in the fact that the wicked will be punished. I wish that punishment wasn't there for them. But I rejoice in knowing that God has had grace upon my soul and from time to time has made himself known to me in such a way that I feel like these promises are mine. Oh, I'm not telling you I don't have doubts from time to time. I do get in situations where I think, Lord, what am I thinking? Why did I ever think I was called to preach? I'm not even sure I'm a child of God. And then there are other times when I rejoice in the things of God like nothing I've ever seen. It's so close to my heart that I can't seem to walk away from it. Psalm 149 says this, and we'll close. Psalm 149:4 says, "For the Lord taketh pleasure in his people." The Lord taketh pleasure in his people. And it says he will beautify. Listen, this is what we're talking about. He will beautify the meek with salvation. I think it's the same statement. The meek shall inherit the earth. God will beautify the meek with salvation. May God bless you is my prayers. I pray that in some way this has been encouraging to you or been a blessing to you in some way. Help you through the coming week. And I trust the Lord will continue to watch over us.